Hi, I'm Amelia, and welcome to the F3 Stories podcast by Messly. This podcast shares the adventures and wisdom of doctors who've taken an F3 year and hopefully can inspire you to create the F3 year of your dreams. In this episode, we speak to Mike, who's a military doctor in the Navy. I've known Mike for a very long time, and if you'd told me a decade ago that one day he'd be a military doctor, I'd have never believed it. The carefree and, to put it delicately, untidy Mike that I knew did not seem the type of person to choose the rigid and structured life of a military doctor. Yet seeing him now, I can completely appreciate how the opportunity has opened up and elevated his life in a way I couldn't have imagined. The Navy has taught Mike so many new skills. Not only can he now iron a shirt and make a bed, but he can work confidently under pressure, provide humanitarian support overseas, and protect and preserve the well-being of his colleagues and patients in challenging circumstances. He's also had the opportunity to travel and pursue his own extracurricular hobbies like kitesurfing and skydiving. In this episode, Mike shares his rationale behind joining the military and committing to a minimum of 5 years of military service. He also describes what life is like for Navy doctors, the highs and lows of the job, and what to expect if someone were to join the Navy in their F3 year. Welcome, Mike.
Hello, Amelia. How are you?
I'm good. How are you? Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks. Very excited to be here.
Can we start by talking a little bit about how you came to be a military doctor?
Yeah, sure. So I suppose for a bit of background, it's worth saying that I went to the same medical school as your boyfriend, or the same university. And then I think we knew each other. And I think we both started in the NHS at a very similar time. And both probably went through a similar kind of disillusionment with being a doctor in the NHS. And then I kind of looked at different ideas. I thought about going to Australia. I thought about leaving and going into finance or consultancy. And then I had quite a close friend that had joined the Navy. And I spent a bit of time talking to her, started the process, went through all my interviews, went through all the military training, and here I am now 5 years later and haven't looked back.
And did you choose the Navy just because your friend chose the Navy, or what were the other options that you had?
So for people interested in joining the military as a doctor, you can join the Navy, the RAF, or the Army. If I'm honest, I probably did join the Navy because I knew, well, because my friend told me it was great and I didn't do as much research as I probably should have done. But I have been really happy since, and I've met Army doctors and I've met RAF doctors. And I think you kind of find your tribe. And I was very lucky to have found the right one in the Navy.
And you joined as an F2 doctor, is that right?
Yeah. So for most people, if you want to go in as a military doctor, you can either go in during medical school, which is called a cadetship, and the military will pay for you your final 3 years of medical school, and they'll give you a salary during that time. Join as a direct entrant, which is at the end of your F2. So you finish your F2 and then you join directly and you'd start kind of being paid by the military then. I was a bit unique in the sense that I went in between my F1 and my F2. So I ended up having 1 year of the cadetship and then starting what they call general duties, which is any time after F2.
Is there a big difference between joining for the cadetship or joining after F2?
So it's the same. You'd eventually be doing the same thing. But there's quite big financial differences. So if you join the cadetship, you know, a lot of my friends that have done that don't have any student loans and they receive quite a generous salary throughout university. So that's the main difference. It's the same contract length, so you sign the same amount of time. So really, I suppose, if you know it's something you want to do, it's better to do it at university than it is to do it as a direct entrant.
Right. So the commitment towards years of service after that is the same either way.
It is, yeah.
Okay. So what's more common? Do people tend to do it in university or join as an F3 or post F2?
I'd say it's probably going as a cadetship at university. As an example, probably, I don't know, I'd say 70% do cadetship and then about 30% a direct entrance at F2. The other option is people sometimes join after specialty training. So you can become a military doctor as a GP. You can be a military orthopedic surgeon later down the career.
How competitive is it to become a military doctor?
Well, it's hard to know, but some years you might have 15 general duty medical officers each year, and some years you can have up to kind of 25 or 30. But it is small numbers, and that's just the Navy. The RAF and the Army will have their own. It's relatively competitive, I have to say. Worth it if you want something a bit different and you're willing to kind of sign on for 5 years.
What were the main positives that were kind of drawing you into that program?
So I think there's huge variety. We'll talk about it a bit more, but there's, depending on which service you join, you go in to do what they call general duty medical officer years, so GDMO years. And in those 3 years, or at least it's 3 years in the Navy, you can get sent to kind of far-flung places. You spend time on ships. There's huge opportunities for travel. Very unique, like training, military training in medicine. There's quite a slant on occupational health. They've got a real focus on adventurous training. So we can talk about it later on, but I've learned to paraglide and to skydive through the military. And there's just, for me, for the kind of things I enjoy outside of work, there were some huge opportunities for joining the military.
And is it the same depending on which branch you join? So would you get the same travel and training opportunities, whether you're in the Navy or the RAF?
So each of them have unique quirks. And I think if people are interested in it, it's worth looking into. There's lots of information online. But the RAF, for example, they just do 1 year in general duties, whereas the Army and the Navy do 3 years. A lot of it is kind of look-based. So depending which unit you end up at or which branch you go into will depend which deployments you do and how much travel you have. I was really fortunate, I suppose, because when my general duty started, it was just at the end of COVID. There was lots of pent-up need to deploy. So lots of deployments were going on and lots of my year were very lucky to be able to spend a lot of time abroad. But I'd say, yeah, the opportunities, they all vary and it really just depend on what kind of work people want to do. Obviously, if you join the Army, it'll be more land-based. Whereas in the Navy, I think there's huge variety because some doctors go on to be submarine doctors. Some doctors will go and work on surface ships. And then some doctors, like I've done, will work alongside the Royal Marines and go down more of a green route.
Can you describe what the application process was like?
My experience really is through the Navy route. And if you want to join through a Navy, you primarily would join as any other kind of officer would want to join the Navy. So you do something called the Admiralty Interview Board, which has changed a lot during the years and COVID made it change as well. It was kind of a 2 or 3 day residential interview. And you go in and you get psychometric testing, you get fitness tested, and then you have to do these kind of like leadership tests. And you go in there with some other candidates. And then at the end of the 2 days or the 3 days, the assessors will put together all your scores from the 3 days, sort of like a mini apprentice, I suppose. And then you find out whether or not you've got your space. But passing the Admiralty Interview Board doesn't necessarily mean that you'll get space. It just means that you benchmark. And then what they'll do is they'll look at all the people who've applied to be general duty medical officers. And if you're above a certain threshold, then you get offered a place in the military.
And you said part of that was fitness testing. Do you mean physical fitness?
Yeah, exactly.
Do you find that, is it the same benchmark for male and female? Is there like is it more difficult to access those programs than as a woman?
No, so they will change. The fitness tests, again, vary service to service. But for example, in the Navy, it's largely based around a 2.4 kilometer run. So you'll do, or a bleep test. And those are adjusted depending for your age and also your sex. It's hard to kind of quantify. You can look all these things up online with the exact like numbers you need depending on your age. But yeah, I'd say you'd have to be relatively fit. But, you know, there's definite variety within the military as well. Some people are extremely fit and some people are, I'd say, not that fit. But yeah, you definitely have to be on the fitter side to pass all those tests.
You've said that when you join the military after your F2 year, it's called general duties. And in the Navy, you've said that's 3 years. So is that the equivalent of doing an F3, 4, 5?
Yeah, exactly. That's a very good way of putting it, I suppose. Yeah, an F3, 4, 5.
And then you would go into specialty training from there.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's quite interesting because you apply, so your contract, so most contracts, at least with the Navy, is that you'd sign on. And then if you come in as a direct entrant, so after your F2, you sign on for 5 years. Mm-hmm. That would be your 3 years of general duties and then 2 years of specialty training. So at the end of your general duties, you then apply for specialties that the military wants. These are mainly like GP, emergency medicine. They do also have radiologists, orthopedic surgeons, plastic surgery. You definitely have to apply to what the military needs.
Looking at your general duties and what's the equivalent of your F3 year, how much of that is medical kind of hospital work and how much of that is military physical fitness kind of stuff?
So it's a really interesting point. I think it's huge variety. And again, it's service dependent. But the way it works in the Navy, for example, is you'll finish your F2 and then you'd have your summer holiday and then you'd go to Britannia Royal Naval College, so in Dartmouth. And then you'd undergo about 3 months of officer training. So if you went in as a normal officer into the Navy, it's quite long the training you'd spend there. You'd spend close to a year there. But as a doctor, you'd just do a shortened version. So you'd be there for about 3 months. and you learn all about the military. They call it militarization. You learn how to march. You learn about the Navy in general. You do some ceremonial things. You get to know what the other officer cadets do. And it's quite an achievement, really. I think everyone goes there. You long days. You'd wake up at 4:30 in the morning on some days and you go and exercises into the field. But then at the end, you have this big pass out and you're then officially a naval officer and also a doctor. So, you know, you make some great friends and it's a really fun part of, it's very different from what a normal doctor would do because it's 3 months of no medicine, just kind of ironing, marching, learning all about naval history.
Learning how to iron. That's cool.
Yeah. It was a big learning curve for me.
Yeah, I know. Not doing medicine for 3 months. Do you still have to do an appraisal at the end of that year?
You do, yeah. We do an appraisal just like NHS trainees do. It's slightly tailored. So we have a military curriculum, which will focus on things like tropical medicine, occupational health, also looks at CBRN threats, so things like chemical, biological, radiological threats, which you wouldn't have to do in the NHS. So we'd have very similar, we have kind of a curriculum that we follow. And over the course of the 3 years, we have to tick a lot of what our NHS colleagues would have to achieve and also some specific military things.
Can you describe what the day-to-day duties are of a military doctor? What kind of specialties and skills and knowledge will you be applying in your normal job?
Yeah, so again, it's hugely varied depending on which service you choose and then not only which service, but which stream you go down. So we talked a little bit about the Navy and we talked about how you can be a submariner or a surface doctor or a Royal Marine doctor, essentially, or a commando doctor that works with the Royal Marines. That's the route that I chose. And if you do choose that route, then you have to do further military training. So I ended up doing an additional 3 months, which was, it's called the All Arms Commando course. And you effectively earn your Green Beret and you spend a lot of time in the field. You learn field craft and you learn kind of commando skills. Because of that, my job is quite unique and it's very different from what a submariner doctor would do or very different from what an RAF doctor would do. But I think all of them have in common, there's a real focus on occupational medicine because our population that we see is very different from the NHS. We see relatively young people who are quite fit because the military's got quite a rigorous screening program before you get in. So we don't see any kind of geriatric patients at all, and we don't see that many people with chronic disease. So what we really focus on is lots of MSK problems, lots of occupational things like, can this person still do their job? Can this person still be trusted with a weapon? Not trusted, but can this person operate the weapon system correctly with the medical condition? I suppose the stereotypes are stereotypes, and it is true that a lot of what we do as well is sort of psychiatry-based things because people struggle with long deployments and you see a lot of anxiety and it's the welfare and the support there and everything that you kind of expect in a young population. So we also do quite a lot of like sexual health stuff. Yeah, it's hugely varied, but we definitely miss a large section of the population. So we don't do much in terms of pediatrics and we don't do that much in terms of women's health. And equally, we don't do any really of geriatric care.
Yeah. And how much of the care that you're delivering is to military personnel and how much is to the people when you deploy somewhere in the local population, the civilian population, I guess, is the word you might use.
Yeah. So again, it's hugely dependent on your role and what you do. If you were to be a surface doctor, for example, then the mass majority of your job would just be looking after the ship that you're on. So you essentially, the people that you work alongside are your patients, which is another real challenge of being a general duties doctor, which really kind of caught me off guard is that you're, in many ways, your colleagues become your patients. And there's all sorts of things to think about there in terms of confidentiality, professional relationships. Again, dependent on the role. If you've kind of watched the news recently, the military had involvement in various things that have been going on quite publicly, like in Sudan. And that would have been the doctors there were dealing with the Sudanese population and entitled people. So there's a real humanitarian slant as well, which is very exciting.
I mean, part of me pictures you as this kind of master and commander doctor and your only friend is the captain of the ship or you're just sitting there playing violin together. But I imagine it must be hard, similar to kind of a GP in a really small community. It must be hard having your patients being your colleagues and your friends.
Yeah, absolutely. It really does pose challenges. Yeah, it's very interesting as well, because I think if you imagine the size of some ships, they're relatively small and there's not much else to do. So lots of people gossip and it's really odd knowing kind of all the gossip. And then also, yeah, everyone always picks your brains and they'll know that someone went to go see you and they want to know the reasons why. And you just got to remain very professional and kind of maintain, remember that you're kind of responsibilities to the patients and maintain confidentiality, really.
Do you find that alienates you from your peers?
Not really. I think it's very personality dependent, but I think you're very privileged as a doctor in the military because you're really admired for your medical skills. And although you've not done the same kind of military training as most of the people, you're also respected as an officer. So you're very welcome. And I think it's very good because you can go and speak to the junior ranks just as easily as you can speak to the captain or the more senior ranks. And it's a real privilege to be able to kind of not be constrained by rank as much as other people are and to really be able to speak to everyone openly and just treat everyone a bit more human.
Do you ever feel out of your depth? I mean, if you were dealing with a kind of a classical cohort of symptoms within your colleague population, and then you're going to do this humanitarian work and perhaps seeing a child or an obstetric patient, which is something you're a bit less familiar with, do you have that senior support and external knowledge to support you in treating those patients?
Yeah. I think although the role comes with huge responsibility, you're very well looked after in the sense that usually if you know you're deploying somewhere and you're doing humanitarian-based stuff, the military will load you onto special courses like tropical medical courses. You can do pediatric ALS courses. And there's other things more specific depending on the region that you're going to. And then I know, again, service dependent, but you'll always, as a GDMO, have reach back. It might be kind of virtually or electronically, or it might be that you deploy with a GP or a senior doctor, but you will always have reach back in one way or another to a senior military GP or a military specialist.
Right. So you can access that senior support if you need to.
Yeah, absolutely.
You've mentioned that military doctors have a tailored educational program and also that there are additional courses that you can access through the military if you're going somewhere in particular or going to be attending a specific population group. It sounds like there's loads of additional opportunities and learning that you can do. Is all of that funded by the military?
It is, yeah. So again, very lucky. I'm kind of out of the loop with how it is in the NHS, but there's lots of there's lots of kind of internal military courses which you can apply for and bid for and then have funded. And there is also pots of money for people that want to go off, and the military funds some people to go and do PhDs, master's degrees and other things if it's beneficial to the military.
Right. So there's a kind of a selection of acceptable courses, but you can perhaps request other ones if you feel you want to.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, definitely.
And what about research? And I mean, part of the NHS training program, you have requirements to participate in audit and QI and research things and develop your career that way. Is that also part of the expectation for a military doctor as well?
It is, yeah. So we meet all of the baseline requirements of kind of NHS trainees for revalidation and things like that. So we're still expected to do quality improvement projects, still expected to do audits and contribute in that front. Again, depending on where you are and things like that, they'll probably have a military slant to them. But again, it depends. Some GDMOs who spend a lot of time in the UK will manage to negotiate A&E. They might go and do one day in A&E a week, as well as their responsibilities. And then they would have more exposure to the NHS and participate in kind of NHS-related audits and quips.
That's interesting. I didn't know when you were kind of based, land-based locally, you could still work in NHS trusts.
Yeah, so what they tend to do is it's an honorary contract. So you'd go, you don't get paid for it, but effectively you're just maintaining your clinical competency while you're in the UK.
Is that a typical thing that military doctors will do?
A lot of them do, yeah. And especially if you've got an interest in a specialty, you'll arrange weeks in, say if you're interested in radiology, you'd arrange radiology weeks and factor that into your timetable and try and do a couple of those each year.
I wanted to talk a bit about your other interests and your other hobbies. So I know you're really into skydiving, you talk about paragliding and kite surfing, and all of these things were passions for you before you entered the military. But I know that since you've joined the military, your ability to kind of do those things has really opened up. And I was wondering how your kind of medical career and your military career has facilitated you being able to do those things.
Yeah, no, really good question, I suppose. I think that's one of the things that really drew me to the military. I think I hoped that I would meet quite like-minded people, especially working with the Royal Marines and down that world. And I've been really fortunate that it has. And I think the military really values rounded people, and it values it. You're entitled to at least 1 week each year of something called adventurous training, which is effectively kind of government or military-funded opportunities for everyone. So it's not just doctors or officers, it's everyone that's in the military to go off and do something that kind of pushes them, whether that's something like kayaking, whether it's skydiving, whether it's paragliding, sailing. And the military is fantastic in the sense that it's got this access to a whole host of different qualifications and kind of locations. The Navy's got a base out in Germany where it holds lots of adventurous training. And then we've got good links with drop zones and skydiving centers in the UK and abroad. And it really does open up this world of kind of subsidized adventurous sports, which has been fantastic for me.
So when you complete your general duties, military doctors then go on to apply for specialty training. Are you competing with NHS employees for training numbers, or is the application for specialty training an entirely different process?
No, it's very much the same. So you have to benchmark in the same way that other NHS trainees would. And in some ways, it's probably a bit more competitive because the military will say this year from a cohort of 20, we have enough space for 6 GPs. And there might be 11 military people that want to do GP. So not only do you have to benchmark against the NHS, you then have to beat the rest of the military GDMOs who are going for whatever specialty it is that you're interested in. So you can be lucky one year and it not be competitive for the specialty you've chosen. And then the year after, there might be 2-to-1 ratio for what might be easier to get in the NHS.
And do you find that because you have this tailored educational program that is different to NHS employees, when you're applying for specialty training and they have these benchmarks that you have to meet, the NHS employees who perhaps have been working nonstop that entire time, do you find it difficult to compete with them to meet those benchmarks?
So I have to say, in general, military trainees do very well, and they do very well when it comes to specialty applications. And I suppose that's one, I think it's quite good to have those extra few years. It's effectively like applying for training after your F5. So you have the extra maturity. You've also got like the variety of working at reach and the responsibility of the military roles. And actually, a lot of people manage to build quite good portfolios because you can, around deployments and time, you can build in, if you want to do surgery, you can get times in theatres. You're almost the master, in some ways, you're the master of your own time. So I think actually you get very competitive people in the military, and it's not surprising for the top plastic surgery applicant or the top orthopaedic applicant for it to be someone from the military.
So what's next for you, Mike?
So I've just finished my general duties. So
congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, the same as, I suppose, you're coming to the end of your F5. So we're kind of on the same level pegging, aren't we, really? We've just taken 3 years out, but just finished that. So the next thing for me is I start GP training, which is going to be quite interesting, joining the NHS again. So kind of looking forward to that challenge, but I think it's going to be very different from the last few years.
How will your GP training integrate with your military commitments? Do you go to 100% NHS training program, or do you still have some kind of contact with military requirements?
You fall under a different deanery, which is quite interesting. So as you'd usually apply into different deaneries, we fall under a defence deanery. So although we're kind of loaned to the NHS, and then we'll follow NHS pipelines, so we follow the same national curriculum for GPs. So we'll spend our first year in a hospital, and that'll be largely NHS work. But all of our reporting chain and everything is dealt with through the defence deanery. So we're still expected to maintain kind of military competencies and fitness and things like that during our NHS training. And then once we've finished the GP training, we then go back to being military GPs effectively.
So your GP training's the same amount of time to CT, it's still 3 years?
It's 3 years. It varies in the sense that we'll do 1 year in secondary care, 1 year which is sort of NHS GP, and then we do 1 year of military-based GP. And that can be broken down, so it doesn't necessarily have to follow the same pattern. Some people will do 8 months NHS secondary care and then go and do a military placement and then kind of jump back into secondary care and then go and do some NHS GP work. So it's a bit more fluid, I suppose. It's not as structured as NHS training.
And how does it work from a geography side? I mean, if with the NHS applications, you can say, oh, I want to be in this region, my family's here, I own a house in this area. Do you get the same kind of control over where you are geographically?
No, so I think that's what I would say. The military, its greatest thing is the variety, but it's also much in the way that doctors who apply to deaneries have to move quite a lot. You might end up doing a placement at Portsmouth and then being sent somewhere else that's a long way away, and potentially being sent to Scotland. Or so it's probably harder to be based in one area if you're in the military and go through training. I think that's fair to say.
I mean, I suppose one of the positives is that the bases can house you and feed you. So at least that is sorted, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a huge host of kind of advantages. And I do think that I felt a lot, well, I do feel a lot more looked after and kind of valued being in the military than I did when I was in the NHS. And you, depending on where you are, either you can live on a base or the military will, in some cases, pay for your accommodation for training, which is a huge perk.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that we're really lucky to have.
And how does it work for military personnel who have partners or families who are non-medical?
You can apply for married accommodation, which, again, depending on your circumstances and your kids and the location, the military will offer you subsidized housing, which is kind of a married patch. So there'll be like an area where the military own quite a few houses and you apply for them. And if you're lucky enough to get one, then you pay like quite heavily subsidized rates to live in that area with your family.
But is the expectation that your partner will move rather than you being able to stay in the area where your partner is?
Yeah, absolutely.
Can you think of any other main positives or downsides to joining the military as a doctor?
Yeah, so I think one big one is, and I think a lot of people are happy doing it now. And one of the things we often talk about, Amelia, is how there's no race to the top. Like, it doesn't seem, I think our kind of cohort of junior doctors now, no one, or a lot of my friends, don't feel the need to race to the top to get the consultancy or to get GP. Mm-hmm. I think the military is fantastic, but it's effectively a 3-year career break. So some of my colleagues now are fully qualified GPs. They're well along the way to being consultants, and I'm only just applying for GP training. So I think if you're the type of person that knows what they want to do, it's a big commitment taking 3 years out. So that would be one of the downsides, if that's what's important to you. And then I suppose the other thing which I wanted to stress is that there's no one size fits all for the military. I think everyone thinks that you've got to be a very military person to join the military. But as you will know, Amelia, I was definitely not very military.
I wasn't going to say anything, but yeah.
You know, I used to visit our student house, and it's safe to say I wasn't like the best ironing person and the most organized military man at university. So I think there's a huge variety of people that join the military, and each service has a type of person. And I think it's got amazing opportunities if you want to travel, if you want the kind of that adventure, if you want exposure to expedition medicine and remote medicine, and yeah, and you're willing to take a few years out and you're willing to kind of test yourself. I think the military is honestly fantastic.
And I think that's a very important point, that you don't have to perhaps be the end product when you apply, because as you say, you were perhaps not the tidiest person I'd ever met before you joined the military, but you know, they shaped you and taught you what you needed to know about ironing and making a bed. But I guess another potential downside for someone is you have this wonderful exposure to certain specialties, but there are other specialties, like you've already said, that you'll have limited exposure to. And if you know you want to be an obstetrician or a gynecologist or a pediatrician or, I don't know, some other specialties, you won't get that exposure as a military doctor, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that a lot of what they say is also it's kind of the military needs come first. So if you know you want to be, as you said, a geriatrician or a pediatrician, the military won't support that. Like, it's very much they'll support what's good for the military and they'll definitely look after you and care about what you think. But we don't have any pediatricians at the moment in the Navy, so the military wouldn't support you in doing that now.
Yeah.
And again, during your general duties, you wouldn't have exposure to those specialities as such.
But then I suppose if you apply for GP training, which is probably one of the more common pathways for military doctors when they go to choose specialty training, as it is for NHS doctors, you will then get your exposure to some of those specialties at least through your GP training, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of the things, we had a talk recently, and it's one of the things that I definitely tried to do in my specialty training, is I'm going to do obstetrics and gynecology, and I'm going to do pediatrics, and I'm a bit apprehensive going to them because I haven't done them for 3 years or really seen any pediatric patients. So, but I think it's really important to get that rounding and to get that kind of wider awareness to be a good GP.
What kind of person would be suited to being a military doctor?
Very cliche, but quite a people person to want to go and join the military and spend long times away with maybe quite a small group of people. It maybe attracts that type of person that is a bit more relaxed and deals with pressure a bit better.
So what kind of person would perhaps not be suited to being a military doctor?
So I think, to be honest, one of the other things that we didn't talk about, downsides, is it's hugely taxing on kind of personal relationships and family relationships, or it can be hugely taxing depending on your situation. So I think for my general duties, for example, in my cohort, there were some people who effectively finished her F2, then went away for 3 months of military training, and then were told that next month you're deploying on a 9-month deployment on a ship. And you can imagine that for some people who've got different family circumstances, that is hugely hard to deal with. And some of those people who went away for 9 months would then be back in the UK for a month or two, and then asked to go on another deployment for another few months. So I suppose that if you're the type of person that is settled and they prioritize kind of family life and having stability, then I don't think the military necessarily, or military GDMO, is the right thing for those type of people.
And is that similar for all the branches, or is there one branch that tends to be more geographically stable than the others?
Again, it's a huge stereotype, but the RAF, again, it depends, but some of the RAF doctors will have a more stable general duties because they only have 1 year. So in that 1 year, they're unlikely to be deployed for a long period. So for their general duties, it's probably more stable in the RAF. And then it's just hugely dependent on which job you choose at the other side of specialty training. You can still be very deployable as a military GP. But for example, if you're a military orthopedic surgeon, you probably have quite a stable life and you're probably based as a consultant in an NHS hospital for 9 months of the year. And then as and when expected to deploy for a few months each year.
What's the coolest thing about being in the military?
It's a really good question. I have to say, I love it. I think there's just so many opportunities. The travel is amazing. The access to adventurous training. The huge responsibility as well. It's such varied work. Like in the NHS, you work in teams, but you don't really have any kind of leadership experience, or you don't get any leadership exposure or management exposure. My time in the military has been unbelievable. I've kind of managed a team of 20 medical people and had these amazing exposures in ships and in different areas. And it's just been brilliant. I think it was a real, and also to be kind of, in one way, in charge of your own schedule. I felt very autonomous. Although you kind of go on deployments and you're asked to go on them, you also manage your own schedule in one way and you choose the kind of courses you want to go on. And yeah, it's been brilliant. So I think it's going to be quite tough for adjusting to the NHS.
That's really interesting hearing that autonomy and control are one of the things that are some of the highlights of being in the military, because it's really not what you would expect as an outsider.
Yeah, and I suppose it's a bit of a double-edged sword because, yeah, I suppose in one way you can be told that you're deploying tomorrow for a 3-month deployment. So that's kind of counter to the autonomy, but there's definitely a lot more autonomy than I felt I had as a F2 in the NHS, for example.
Yeah, because as an NHS employee, you might apply for a foundation or a training program and you still get told where you're going to live, what job you're going to do, and you might not have much control over that as well.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, as a lot of people say, it's pretty relentless life, isn't it, in the NHS? And I think the military in general, not just with doctors, you'll have periods where you work very hard, but then also when you're back on land, that's your chance to kind of do things for your own professional development, your own personal development. And the military in general is really quite supportive of that, which I think is something we don't see so much in the NHS, which is a real shame.
But where could someone find the information about these different branches and what might be, what kind of training they could expect and the program of application and all of that stuff? Where could they find that information?
Yeah, so I think it's a good point. I think the other thing to say about that is it's quite a long process, because to get your medicals cleared and to go through all those interviews, it's not something that you're able to do in a couple of months. I think it's something that you, from the day you start your application to the day you start in military training, whichever one it may be, kind of minimum of 1 year. So I suppose the first thing to say is people who are interested in doing it, either at medical school and cadetships, or probably most people who listen to the podcast, maybe you're coming towards the end of your F1. If it's something that you're interested in, have a look on the Navy website, Royal Navy. Equally, have a look on the Army websites and the RAF, and just type in medical officer in all those three branches. And there you can find out huge amounts of information on the process, the application process for each of the different services. But I would say it takes about a year. So if it's something you're interested in, do it sooner rather than later. And I do think it's probably more of, they would say it's like a young man's game, but that's a young person's game, in the sense that I think it's harder to do as you get older, because inevitably you'll have more commitments in terms of family and things like that. So if it's something you're interested in doing, I'd say do it sooner rather than later. And you can really make a career out of it. A lot of people don't just do the general duties. Like me, they'll stay in the military and hopefully have a full career in whichever branch they choose.
So you would say in your F1 year, you should really be researching, and F2 you should be applying if you want to be starting as soon as F2 ends.
Yeah, I'd say so. I think you'd kind of get your application in beginning of F2 would be kind of the earliest. If you know it's something you want to do, then get it in F1, get it in as early as possible.
And is there key application deadlines like there is with NHS training programs? So with Oriel, they'll open up in October and close in November or close in December, and then they won't process any applications after that point.
So I have to say, not that I'm aware. I think once you, so you have to pass your AIB or whichever board it is that you do, and then there'll be a few months until the next board. And the Navy, for example, I think it has two boards each year. So you, depending on your timing, you might miss the window for 1 year and have to go for the year after. But unfortunately, I don't know those exact timings, but there's no set hard timing. And if needs be, you'd then be pushed just to the year after.
You know, you have the information on the websites, but do you ever have open days or Q&As where people can speak to military doctors and get more of a first-hand account, or is it all kind of the information that's on the website?
Yes, they have, again, it depends on the services, but they have, I went on like a kind of taster weekend, and it was a Navy thing, but I went to my local military center. It was called an AFCO, and each city should have them, and they'll have ones for the Army, the RAF, and the Navy. And they'll just be kind of career advice centers you can go to. And you can say that you're interested in being a medical officer. And then through them, they will arrange these. I don't know if they still exist or if they exist through the services. Certainly in my time, they had these kind of taster weekends where you could go and have a look at what military life is like in the Navy. You could meet some of the medical officers in the Navy and kind of see if it was what you wanted.
Do you have any final advice for anyone who's considering looking into or applying to become a military doctor?
Final bits of advice. I think just go for it. It's very exciting. It's a big commitment is the other thing. So I suppose just go for it isn't very good advice, actually. I think we spend a lot of time thinking about if it's something you want to do. And it is a huge commitment because 5 years is not something that you sign up to very quickly. So spend some time thinking about it. But for me, I've never looked back. And it was definitely the right decision for me. And I've really enjoyed it. And it's given me some amazing opportunities. And I've been on some great adventures through the military. So yeah. It definitely is a good alternative to Australia or management consultancy or lots of the other options that people are looking at.
Yeah, so if you're disillusioned with the NHS, there are options for you. Yeah, it's not all just go to Australia or leave. Thank you so much for sharing all of your wisdom and experiences. I'm sure it'll be hugely helpful for people who are considering this as an option or even people who haven't considered it as an option, starting to understand what that career move might be able to offer them. So thank you.
You're more than welcome. Thanks for having me on the show, Amelia. It's always good to catch up.
I hope that you've enjoyed listening and gained some valuable insights into what you want to do during your F3 year. Don't forget to check out the show notes for related links and articles about the topics discussed in this episode. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please consider leaving a review, sharing it with your friends and colleagues, or subscribing to hear more interviews with doctors in the future.